Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
Lord, I wish I could forget you, but your memories are all that makes me feel alive.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Mark Curry? Do y'all like Mark? Originally from Texas, Mark Curry now makes Little Rock home. Mark has shared the stage with Wanda Jackson and Billy Joe Shaver. Mark can be found at markcurry.com. All right, well, welcome to Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. We are on location at the Oyster Bar in Little Rock, Arkansas. Tales from the South is presented by Temino's Publishing Company, and I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here, playing for us tonight, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark is a frequent performer at the King Biscuit Blues Festival in Helena, Arkansas, and he has shared the stage with the late blues legend Robert Jr. Lockwood. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? You like our set? We like to feature an artist on our shows. So this week, along with our Delta Screen Doors with Mixed Media Portraiture by Arkansas artist V.L. Cox, we are featuring 11-year-old Sophia Morrell's art with this piece right here entitled Cardinal. Sophia is here tonight. She's right here in the front. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Sophia at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight, our storytellers are all in sticky situations and find themselves thinking, well, that was embarrassing. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Marty Bauer is floored in more ways than one, and will end the night selling cars and attitude with John Wells. But let's start the night here at Tales from the South with Grant Rollins, who thinks, mistakenly, he's off the embarrassment hook in Happy Birthday, Schopenhauer.
On the eve of my and my brother's birthdays, our parents always asked the same question. What do you want for your birthday breakfast? Because the typical Rollins breakfast consisted of burnt toast and bran gruel, having the normal panoply of breakfast food available dazzled us. Anything? They nodded. Anything. This exchange occurred every year, but each time we couldn't believe our good luck. We weighed our choice like a last meal and then took full advantage. Cream-laden long johns, toast heavy with apple butter, crispy bacon, summer sausage, cookies masquerading as cereal, you name it. If we died at 12 from sugary shock, that was fine by us. When the big day arrived, our bedroom door creaked open around dawn, revealing Mom and Dad looking as thrilled as they were when we were first born. They held a bronze tray on which sat our requested meal nested between a solitary rose and a burning candle. I don't know if they practiced beforehand, but they had happy birthday timed so well to their entrance and slow walk that their shaky warbling ended precisely as they lay the tray in our laps and sat on either side. We dug into steaming goodness as they, twinkling, recounted the story of our birth. I'll spare you the details of mine, but I will say that when I finally popped out, the doctor suggested, because February 6th was also President Reagan's birthday, that my parents should name me Ronald Reagan Rollins. Thankfully, my parents were not as enamored by alliteration. They chose Grantland Johnston instead, making any destiny besides theme park owner impossible. I cried on nearly every birthday as a child, and the first time I remember was when I turned 4. Mom had searched her penny whistle birthday party book and had chosen a cowboy and Indian theme. She and I were back in my room getting ready when the first guest arrived. She adjusted my cowboy hat, hitched up my holster, and then I swiveled Wayne-like toward the other little Pocahontases and Wyatt Earps playing in the living room. When I rounded the corner, I beheld a wall of cowhide and feathers. Then I heard, "It's the birthday boy," and 3 million eyes lasered my way. No matter where I looked or moved, there they were, watching, waiting, wanting, crying out for me to be happy, to be excited. Be happy. Be excited. You're you. I politely declined. I didn't think a fourth consecutive year of survival was much of a reason to shriek with joy. Suffering beneath an insistent and silent Lord of the Flies-like drumbeat for positive emotion, however, was reason enough for me to sob uncontrollably, run to my room, and hide under my bunk bed. My poor dad followed behind and lay on the ground for an hour, trying to explain to the shadows why parties are happy things. I wasn't convinced, and I'm still not. The birthday party must be a relic of the Black Plague, when survival really was an accomplishment. And celebration is about accomplishment, right? The alternative is oddly deflating, as if the festivities will occur no matter how terrible, boring, or moronic I happen to be in reality. It's the planned aspect of birthdays that do this, I think. Planned celebrations sound like planned sex or planned worship. They're not bad and perhaps unavoidable, but the spontaneous kinds are better, wilder, truer. Nobody planned a party for snow days or when there was a substitute or when you got a letter. You simply partied. Unfortunately, my parents, cliche as ever, loved me not for any particular characteristic of mine, but simply because I was theirs. Oh well. This unconditional love, I eventually learned, would follow me even to college, which was surprising because I'd assumed, being a few hundred miles away and far too old for mush, that the birthday breakfast song and dance was officially dead and gone. This is why I went to bed on the night of February 5th, expecting to slumber long and well into the beginning of my 19th year. I assumed wrong. When the clock struck 6 a.m., my door went boom, and an air horn rang out. My roommate Peter and I shot up in fright. Our first thought was that we were the hapless victims of senile or pensionless senior hoodlums, too old to care about consequences, but also too old to discern victims worth robbing. They're lucky neither of us kept a gun under the pillow. Our fears melted, however, and nerves thin once my mother began howling, "Happy birthday!" while throwing a pound of sparkly confetti on my bed and around the room. Gone were the days of roses and tender singing. The era of the loud, deranged fairy had arrived. My dad, meanwhile, held up the huge chocolate cake in his hands for us to see. "Come on, guys, up and at 'em. We want to take y'all to breakfast." I looked over at Peter. He was still rubbing his eyes, wondering whether the commotion was just a nightmare. I then spied my next-door neighbor, out of breath and shirtless, step outside his door. "Everything okay?" "It's fine, Nick. Just my parents, not a SWAT team." "Nick can come too," my mom chirped. I groaned. "How did y'all get here so early?" My mom hooted. "We drove up last night and stayed at that new Red Roof Inn. Have you ever been over there? Down by Six in College. It's real nice. And Grant, they have the biggest begonias I think I have ever seen. You might go over there and check it out sometime." My head ached. Could we do lunch? Well, of course they could. They left the cake and waltzed out, likely in search of more flora. The door shut and Peter looked over at me draped in glitter. He started giggling. "Well, happy birthday." I considered keeping up with tradition and collapsing into tears right there, but I was too shocked and tired, and my tear ducts were clogged with multicolored confetti regardless. Nevertheless, I managed to scowl at the feckless pixie dust coating me and try to get back to sleep, wondering along the way why the good Lord had decided to plague me with all this love and affection, and why I, the ghost of Schopenhauer, only dumber, was still 4 years old and unable to enjoy my birthday.
Grant Rawlins is a Little Rock writer who hopes to publish a collection of humorous essays. More can be found at mypoormombook.wordpress.com. Next on Tales from the South, a teenage Marty Bauer sees more than he can handle in The Cold Hard Facts.
The Cold Hard Facts. I am 14. This could portend just about anything. However, this particular tale and introduction is of tragedy, miracle, and, well, you tell me. It's mid-summer, July. My family and I have just moved to the big city, that's in capital letters, in June. I know no one, absolutely no one. I'm scheduled to enroll as a freshman in high school in the fall, a school with 2,500 students. That's as big as the town I moved from. There's little for me to do this summer but to allow my imagination to run rampant about the sophistication of the big city kids and my transition from big frog to tadpole. One fine weekend day, Dad, in an effort to keep me engaged, asks me to accompany him to the hospital where he is to give an anesthesia for a delivery. Pass gas was actually the words he used. I respond with his adultery, yeah, sure, because after all, I had no interest in being in medicine. I had grown up with a family practitioner who was gone in the morning before I got up and didn't get in until well past my bedtime, and I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I knew that was not it. Anyway, suiting up in scrubs, cap, mask, shoe covers, that was pretty cool. And it helps to kind of conceal my excitement and anxiety about what I'm to encounter. I'm sure Dad tries to prepare me, but I retain nothing. As I follow Dad into the delivery room, I am simultaneously very grown up, sophisticated, knowledgeable, and at the same time very childish. These masked figures clad in green, just like me, are moving about the room in quiet resolution. But it was immediately apparent that something terrible was going on. We had arrived too late. This huge woman was lying on a table in the middle of the room, screaming words that, well, perhaps it was just as well that I didn't understand most of them. She is covered in green sheets with her legs up in the air, and I'm directed down towards the foot of the table where I behold, for the first time, that part of the female anatomy that I had only until that very moment imagined. Now, who knows what thoughts, emotions, fantasies I might have experienced had events allowed. However, no sooner was I positioned than blood and fluid gushed forth from this particular part of the anatomy. It was obvious things were going very, very wrong. The screaming ceased. She was dying. If not already dead. Such calm in the delivery room. Everyone is so cool in the face of such crisis and sorrow. The nurses and doctors remain unruffled. How do they do that? Suddenly, another scream. She lives! And those formerly mentioned parts bulge, part in this glistening, purple, bloody, slimy thing sort of becomes apparent. Unfortunately, it appears to be stuck. And as this poor woman once again slumps into what is surely her final coma, the bulge recedes. Suddenly, the bulge reappears. And it grows, and there is some more horrendous sound, but good Lord, a head pops out. It is bloody. It is purple. It is moribund. Another pause, while the doctor very calmly wipes the head and suctions the nose and various orifices, I presume to make the body presentable. another whimper from the mother, and out from all this chaos, following the head, slithers a body, just as bloody, just as purple, and just as dead. After cutting a piece of intestine from the child's belly, the other end is protruding from those parts I mentioned earlier. They hustle the corpse to a nearby table to administer the last rites. My gaze turns to Mother, who I discover, while gravely afflicted, is not yet dead. But just as a combination of relief at her survival, amazing as it is, the sorrow, the grief for the loss of her child is flooding through me, another scream, maybe this one is more of a moan, emanates from the mother as the physician pulls on that hunk of intestine and her entire insides plop out into a pan. This is surely the end. How, I mean, how calm the staff remains. What are they made of? What horrors they must have witnessed to remain so controlled, so matter of fact, not a sign of anxiety, not a suggestion of sorrow. Is this what the practice of medicine does to people? My reverie is broken by a summons to the table of the last rites. And miracle of miracles, the baby is alive, is pink, is breathing. What a cruel trick of fate. That the child should live, however miraculously, only to have its mother die in such agony. He has miraculously arisen from the dead since my last glimpse of him. But it is also apparent from his appearance and from the bustle of activity around him that he needs further procedures in order to keep him alive. His lower half is covered by a green towel, and all but his penis is covered, and so they swab the penis with this toxic-smelling stuff, and then they grab it with these clamps and pull it up, and what's that cold hardness on my face? Tile. What's tile doing on my face? Why am I leaning against the wall? Oh, I'm horizontal, lying on the floor.
Marty Bauer is a retired pediatric pulmonologist who had the honor and privilege of working at Arkansas Children's Hospital for 10 years. Until this tale, his literary career has been limited to basic science and medical research articles. He lives with his wife, Patty, in Little Rock, Arkansas. In our final story of the night here at Tales from the South, John Wells tries his best to not come unglued in Toy Cars.
Hi, my name is John. I'm a recovering car salesman.
Hi, John!
Thank you. Thanks to God's grace and the fact that I work my program one day at a time, I have not found it necessary to sell a car today, nor for the last 24 years. For that, I am grateful. Being a car salesman is not exactly a reason to shoot myself, but it was close. There were fond memories, but just as many bad ones. There was always that customer or that boss or that coworker. The best part was the tight-knit group we had over the years. All had nicknames. Big Daddy, Lid, Bogus, Peter Paul, Moon, Mats, Hambone, and more. Colorful names with personalities to match. I was Ren 10-10, the doghouse lawyer. You'd call me Ren 10 for short. It was reflective of my being the first shaggy dog long hair to indoctrinate into the group. I was later Blind John, then Blondie, and ultimately Blonde, the later sticking well into gray hair and baldness. I love the story behind each one of those nicknames, particularly Matt's, but I digress. We were bad to play pranks on one another, particularly the newbies. When you were the victim, the key was, no matter what, don't come unglued. It was such a critical element of rookie survival, they even covered it in the training. Don't come unglued, you'll avoid becoming a regular target. Come unglued, it's all but certain. Or you could do what Moon did. He emerged from training, entered the showroom, and promptly challenged Bogus in front of the group. You can't make me come unglued. Oh, don't say that. Bogus was the penultimate prankster. He was in a league of his own. Many tried in utter futility to get him to come unglued. It never happened. Moon alone was the only one who was ever bold enough to try it as a rookie. You don't tug on Superman's cape, you don't spit into the wind, and whatever else you think you might do, you definitely don't mess around with Bogus. But Moon had a plan. He plotted to hide Bogus's beloved horn, a beautiful black coronet, in the trunk of a car on the showroom floor. Bogus immediately noted its absence and just as quickly found it, having no doubt who hid it. Then he hid it again. The stage was set. Let the show begin. Enter Bogus acting as if he had come completely unglued. Somebody better bring me my coronet. I make money with that horn. You don't mess with my money. Moon smugly mocked Bogus. Hey, man, don't come unglued. He then sauntered confidently to the crime scene. He calmly turned the key, stared straight into the abyss of an empty trunk, and turned white as a sheet. The hook was set. Bogus owned Moon, and he knew it. Bogus exploded. He angrily handed him the yellow pages and insisted he call every pawn shop in town. Moon, having little choice, obeyed. Bogus then got his own phone book out, went to the middle of the alphabet, and got a pawn shop owner in on the gag. So when Moon called that one, the owner replied, "Sure do, bought a horn just like that just a few minutes ago. I'll take $300 for it." Moon almost passed out. $300 in the mid-70s was way more than he could afford. Then poor Moon promptly came unglued. Bogus showed no mercy. It was like watching Snoopy and the Red Baron. Then as Moon made the long walk to the car to drive to the pawn shop, Bogus finally let him off the hook over the loudspeaker. In those days, the hours were just awful. It was 6 days a week, minimum 8 hours a day. Summers were even worse. We worked alternating 12-hour days, particularly horrible when your late nights were on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. In the summer of 76, one beautiful Thursday evening, I was so excited to leave at 5:30. It was so beautiful, I hesitated long enough to put the top down. That was a big mistake. That gave the manager just time enough to catch me. I had a customer waiting. I vowed to myself to run this customer off with all of the intentional rudeness I could muster. I wanted to go home. Inside, a small Asian man awaited. His name I will never forget, Toy Kong Pham. He immediately took control of me, insisting that I take the car across town to show his wife. I wondered if I would ever get home. Back at the dealership, he dillied, then he dallied as he slowly made his decision. When things ran in his favor, his English was flawless. Otherwise, he feigned confusion. It was unnerving. He was still vacillating when the store closed at 9. He ultimately signed on the dotted line at 9:45, and I finally prepared to go home. Then I couldn't find my keys. In all the reparking and hustle and bustle, I'd lost them somewhere. Bogus tried to help. We started by searching my desk, drawer by drawer. He asked me where all I'd been. I said, "Where all I'd been? Hell, fam dragged me all over the dealership. He wanted to see the service department, the body shop, the parts department. Where hadn't I been?" Patiently, Bogus stuck with me every step of the way as I revisited each spot. I was distraught. I'd been there 14 hours on my early day. I just wanted to go home. Finally, we returned to my office to check once more, and there they were in the same desk drawer where we started. Bogus had hit them there. 10:30 p.m., unglued, I finally headed home. 10 short hours later, I returned for my third 12-plus-hour day in a row. The bank called back very quickly. They weren't touching Toy Kong Pham with a 10-foot pole. He was a Vietnamese refugee, not a citizen, too much of a flight risk. It had all been for naught. Several months later, I moved to Utah for a couple of years, sold cars there for a bit, and then got out of the car business altogether. But I just couldn't seem to find a job that paid enough money, so ultimately in 1981, I again relapsed into the car business. Within days, standing on that same showroom, I spied a customer that I knew in a flash was the immortal Toy Kong Pham. 5 years later, I instantly recognized him. I stood tall and gathered myself up and did what any truly professional car salesman would do. I hid in the bathroom. I emerged. Pham was still unattended. I returned to the bathroom. At this point, I didn't care if everyone in the place thought I had diarrhea. I was not going back out there. The next peek revealed that my friend Larry Mosher was waiting on him. To my amazement, with no hassle whatsoever, Pham just bought a car. It took maybe an hour. And now a citizen employed full-time as an engineer, the bank cheerfully approved. Just like that, Mosher earned an easy sale and a nice commission. Or so it seemed. With the deal done, it would only take an hour or so to get the car ready, so Toy Kong Pham kept shopping. Minutes later, he called from a competitor's showroom floor telling Mosher that they were willing to throw in the floor mats. As a side note, the floor mats in question were the cheapies. No one would ever have worried about throwing them in. Had Pham just asked for them up front, Mosher would gladly have conceded them and his commission would have suffered a mere $4. Now, after the deal, Mosher would have to pay full price for them, not exactly a deal breaker at $16. Instead, Mosher stood his ground. If you are a man of honor, you'll keep your word and come get your new car, adding, and I quote, "But my wife and I are not going to buy you a set of floor mats." Well, Pham was not a man of his word. He bought the car right there where he sat. All because Mosher, now forevermore to be called Mats, would not throw in the cheapy floor mats. To this day, he still holds the honor of being the only car salesman in history to give up a deal over a $16 set of floor mats. And for as long as Pham stayed at that job, Mats continued a weekly ritual. He'd get this childlike excitement in saying something like, "Oh, it's time." And he'd run to his desk and dial the number. "Toy Kong Pham? Yes." That was long before caller ID. That dealership has long since moved. The building is still there. Bogus passed away years ago. I've lost touch with Mats and most of the group. Peter Paul is still in the business and tells me it's much better now. Perhaps one day I'll relapse and try again, but until then I'll ask for God's deliverance one day at a time.
John Wells is from Little Rock. He writes a weekly email newsletter under his pen name, John the Beer Snob, dedicated to furthering craft beer education and events. It is available through his website at johnthebeersnob.com. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers. Thank you to our live audience here at the Oyster Bar in Little Rock, Arkansas. And thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by Temino's Publishing Company. And our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by the Writers Colony at Dairy Hollow, UALR's Department of Rhetoric and Writing, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, Urban Garden Montessori, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio. You can download and listen to our podcast on our website. We are open for submissions from Southerners. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Again, my name is Mark Curry. And if you have any interest in looking me up, you can find me on the internet at markcurry.com. And that's Curry with an E, by the way. C-U-R-R-E-Y.
have packed away my dreams and I have followed every bitter wind that blew another name. I have locked away my dreams in fear of failing, turned my back against the dance of dying flame. And I have known the joy of beauty unprotected, and I have seen a roof suspended without walls. And I have fallen on my knees to beg forgiveness, and I have risen without fear to face you all. Taking one step toward tomorrow, putting away what you can use. You'll never go until you know. And I have seen my granddad thumbing some old flat top, singing something about a train he's waiting for. And I have heard him lift his ragged voice to Jesus about a beggar who is not poor anymore. And I have seen my daddy staring at a bottle, and I have watched him as he walked away again. And I have seen an angry boy become a father, pray to heaven that he'd never be like him. And I believe that every journey starts with putting on your shoes, taking one step toward tomorrow, throwing away what you can't use. You'll never go until you move. It's always darkest in the morning. This crooked road is never clear. And I may not know where I'm going. Oh, but I know I can't stay here.
So much. Enjoy the rest of the evening.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast in Little Rock. More at robinwoodbnb.com. And the Baker House Bed and Breakfast in North Little Rock. More at bakerhousenlr.com. Live sound and studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio in North Little Rock. More at infraredstudioproductions.com. You too can experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. We're now traveling throughout Arkansas and the South, bringing Tales to your community. Details on hosting a live show, our schedule, and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern-style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week on Tales from the South.